Morning. I'd like to bring this meeting of House Education Committee to order. It is 8:05 on Monday, March 2nd. President Kelly, Munoz, Wilson, myself, Chair Seaton. There's been a number of different meetings around, and people will have to be coming in and going out different times this morning. So just to make everybody aware of that, wanted to remind everybody, including myself at this time, to check their cell phones. And sorry about that.
How much does it cost us again if it goes off?
Yeah. Got to figure out how to. Just not quite being prepared there. Today we're going to hear three bills. We're going to hear H. Bill 147, Education Funding for Instruction. That's the 70% requirement. There's H. B. 58, Educational Loan Repayment Program. And there's H. B. 126, Foster Care and Education of Homeless Foster Children. So we will start today with House Bill 147. We have Hannah Harrison. Would you come forward, Hannah? She's the intern in my office. She'll be presenting the bill for us, for the committee. You will see in the packet there is a sponsor statement. We talked about this at an earlier meeting about whether after the concerns were expressed as to whether we wanted to bring this forward as a committee bill for discussion. There is no requirement that a committee member support this bill if they don't wish, but we brought it forward as a committee bill because it's a topic that we that there's quite a bit of interest in. So is there anything else to come before the committee before we get started? Good morning. Hannah, would you go ahead and identify yourself for the record and begin with the presentation of the bill.
Morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Hannah Harrison. I'm an intern through the University of Alaska Legislative Internship Program in Mr. Chair's office. Good morning to the committee. House Bill 147 repeals the Alaska Statute 1417-520. This was written into the statute 10 years ago, and it placed a requirement of 70% of a school district's operating budget expenditure be dedicated to the instructional component of the budget.
Just for clarification, was that 70%?
70, yes.
Okay, thank you.
This was the rule was written into statute, and it was considered an accountability measure. It was to really measure what was going on in school district budgets, how much was being dedicated toward the students in the classroom, as opposed to, and just to kind of separate those things, as opposed to an operating budget or as opposed to maintenance in a school. This applies to all school districts across the state, whether or not they're a single school district or kind of the more traditional school district with multiple schools within it. Now, this has become a problem lately because of the rising cost of education. Energy costs, particularly in rural areas, has, as I'm sure you're aware, risen substantially over the last few years and continues to be unpredictable. There are two types of school districts that continuously have a difficult time meeting the 70% requirement, and those are districts that have a budget under $3 million and districts that spend 20% or more of their budget on operating costs and maintenance. Currently, the process, if you do not meet the 70% as a of the operating budget as a school district, you must go through a waiver process. And this requires writing out an appeal as to why you did not meet that 70%, submitting it to the Board of Education, and having them either approve or deny it. If they deny it, you can rewrite your budget. You can try and meet that 70% in a different way, or they can approve it, in which case a waiver is then supposed to go to the Legislative Audit and Budget Committee, and where it is supposed to be evaluated, and they are supposed to provide recommendations. Now, up until this point, from the individuals I've spoken to in doing the research for this bill, the review and recommendation process has only occurred up to one time. The staffer that kind of manages that committee has changed throughout the years, and it's been kind of difficult to ascertain whether that actually occurred or not, but it certainly has not been a yearly process, and it has not occurred for every waiver. So the current problem is that it's a very time-consuming process, and because of No Child Left Behind and other acts and other appropriations that have come into place since the original writing of this statute, there are many other oversight processes that go on to manage a district's budget and to make sure that students are getting a worthwhile education and that money is being spent in the classroom as opposed to just on building maintenance. So really the matter is that this has become kind of an outdated piece of law. It could be repealed and there would still be a very adequate and successful oversight process in making sure schools are responsibly spending their budget and being accountable for where their money goes. So I'd like to make sure we get to some of the other individuals who are here today. They have some really good testimony that will kind of demonstrate from a perhaps more closer to home perspective what's really been going on with this issue. So, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Does anyone have a question for the sponsor? Or the sponsor's presenter? Okay, let's go to, I will open public testimony on the bill, and let's go to whoever signed in first has handwriting that I can't read. Carlson?
Yes.
Mr. Carlson. And would you come forward to the other seat here?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to sit?
That's quite the way to start in the morning if you can't read my writing as an educator. My name is Richard Carlson, and I'm the superintendent of the Klock City School District.
Welcome. Would you go ahead and give us your thoughts on this?
Thank you. Thank you. Well, good morning, Chairman Seaton, members of the committee, and thank you for this opportunity to testify in favor of House Bill 147, which would repeal the 70% requirement in instruction. It's better known as the 70% rule, I think, by a whole lot of us. While I represent the Klock City School District, I think it's worth noting that the State Board of Education, the Alaska Association of School Boards, and the Alaska Association of School Administrators have all been quite vocal opposing the 70% rule and in favor of repealing the law. However, as I said, I represent the Klock City School District, and I believe a little bit of perspective on my school district may be helpful. We are a small single-site school district of 125 students on Prince of Wales Island, which is in southeast Alaska. The demographics include 74% of our students are Native Alaskan. Two-thirds, 66% of our kids are impoverished. And if you take a look at the educational statistics, our school should not be a successful school. And just based on what educational statistics say about minority students and students impoverished. However, our school district has really sort of bucked that trend. We've always made annual yearly progress, AYP. Our dropout rate is right around 2%, consistently around 2%. Our attendance rate is about 95%. Our test scores are impressive. Our students go to, most of our schools go on to post-secondary education. Recently, we were named as one of the top high schools in America by U.S. News and World Report. And by every measure, we're a successful school district. And yet, annually, I have to spend a good amount of time and energy justifying how I expend our money. Annually, I have to write a waiver. And it's just not the process of writing the waiver. During the course of the year, I'm put in a situation where I have to break out our budget, for example, in transportation, to determine how much of our time is spent transporting our kids to swimming classes, because that's considered towards the 70%. How much time of our athletic or activity director's time is dedicated towards activities that would qualify for the 70%, for example, academic decathlon or a music festival. It becomes extremely time-consuming and burdensome. But it's not so much the time. I get paid to do that. But it really, for me, it goes more at the core of local control And who is in the best situation to determine how money is to be allocated, whether it is an arbitrary number set in statute or whether it is people that serve the school district, school board members, and community members? I would obviously argue that the people closer to the school district would be the more appropriate people to make that decision. In the Quonset City School District, we have a mission statement that highly values providing a well-rounded educational program and educating the whole student. In our mission statement, and I would be very happy to provide you a copy of that, there's a big emphasis on developing leadership skills, on teamwork, on developing a good, strong work ethic, on developing a sense of responsibility for students and other folks. And those are sorts of things that are not always something that you learn only in the classroom. Many of those skills are learned outside the classroom and consequently outside the 70% criteria. Again, we believe that we are best in the situation to determine what is in the best needs of our students and not some arbitrary number set in statute. On a more practical level, increasing energy costs, the cost of facilities, and the cost of state and federal unfunded mandates have made it increasingly difficult to reach the 30%. Clearly, we feel accountability is critical, but we feel that there are many, many better ways to determine the success of a school district than simply an arbitrary number against set in statute. Therefore, we very much favor House Bill 147 and the repeal of the 70% rule. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to address any questions that you may have if that's appropriate, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And before we do the questions, I just want to say from my position as chair, I want to congratulate the school district on its great achievements. AYP is a difficult thing to get to, especially on a continuous basis. And with the raising standards and all, I really appreciate the educational work that's going on in your community. So
thank you.
Just want to make sure that before we get to questions and debate that this committee at least recognizes that's a great standard to have achieved. Representative Wilson, then Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rich, and this is something I'm going to ask each school superintendent so everybody can count that I'm going to ask this question. There are across the state some schools that pay their board members quite a bit money for being board members, and I would like to know, do your board members get paid for being board members, and how much?
$75 a month.
Okay.
And every one of my board members, to the best of my knowledge, donates most of that money back to the students.
Okay, and when they travel, is their spouse included in the travel?
No, absolutely not.
Okay, thank you. And I want to commend you, too, on what the chair has said. Any school that's making the AYP should be very, very proud.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Keller, and then Munoz.
Yeah, thanks, and commendations on the good work in your school district.
Thank you.
You mentioned the fuel costs. I was just, this is maybe a question for that I you can help me with, just confused, but there's nothing in the 70-30 that allows for part of the fuel bill to be allocated for the heating of the classroom. I mean, where is that? The guidelines for that application are not in statute, are they? I mean,
they are not. No, it is counted against the 70% criteria. So I think this last spring, when we saw skyrocketing fuel costs, I think a lot of us kind of threw up our hands and said, there's just no way. I mean, particularly those of us that were sort of on the cusp before the energy costs just made it almost impossible.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Keller.
Do you think, exploring here, but do you think that if we got a regulation change, maybe that would allocate, because I think it's a pretty good argument for instructing children, you've got to have a warm classroom. You know, in other words, if we take a portion of that operating cost and allocate it, that would be done at the regulatory level, and that's an option maybe on this, right?
That certainly would help, Representative Keller. We still talk about the local control and who's making the determinations, and that's...
Of course. Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. I see in one of the charts that your district is experiencing declining enrollment, and I'm just wondering if you could speak to that and what are some of the factors leading to that.
Thank you. I believe Southeast Alaska in general is experiencing declining enrollments, and certainly Prince of Wales Island. This year, I believe the figures are about 6.4% we decline. And if you just take in consideration the outgoing seniors, we have a relatively large senior class with incoming kindergartners, we're going to decline again next year by probably another 4 or 5%. The fixed costs remain the same, whether you have 300 kids in the building or you have 119. And so again, it becomes very, very difficult on an ongoing basis to reach that 70% just from a statistical fashion. Those of us have been around a while, there are ways to kind of maneuver the numbers, but I would argue that's really not what we're all about. We're not about maneuvering numbers. We're really about trying to educate kids and making the best decisions that are, in their best interest.
Right, and it is a factor throughout Southeast. It's not just Kluwak that is experiencing it, it's of concern. Could you also tell me what percentage of administrators you have to your total workforce at Kluwak, and what percentage are teachers?
We have myself as a superintendent, and we have a high school principal or a K-12 principal, and then we have a business manager, and that's really it. We have on the certified level, there are two of us, and I think there's 14 teachers. And some of those are paid for out of federal funds as well. So.
Thank you.
And I just point out to the committee that in one of our packet items from came from the commissioner's office, I believe, you'll find the waiver for the Kluwak School District request for the operating budget expenditures in 2009 and 2008, and they're all set out on there as far as administrative expenses and operation and maintenance, and of course, as we can see, operation and maintenance is the largest piece of that. So, just so we can have that relative data, because that's, I believe, Representative Keller, what you were talking about was an operational cost of fuel costs, and operation and maintenance is not considered part of the instructional, so therefore that drives up. Although, as you recognize, it is necessary to have a building, have it heated to instruct kids. Are there any other questions for Mr. Carlson? Seeing none, thank you very much. Appreciate not only your work but your input to us today.
Thank you very much, and I'll try to work on my handwriting.
Eugene Avery. Welcome, and would you identify yourself and who you represent for the committee, and then go ahead.
Be glad to. I'm happy to be here this morning. My name is Gene Avey. I'm the superintendent at Annette Island School District. We're the southernmost school district in the state, and we have a wonderful student body and staff that represents the kids and does everything they can to be successful. We, too, are a school district that has successfully made AYP in the last couple of years. And I must say that that has to be primarily due to the dedication of our teachers. I am a first-year superintendent at the Annette Island School District, so I follow a great leadership and board's efforts in attaining that high level of achievement. I'm here today to support House Bill 147, the repeal of minimum expenditure requirement. I believe that with all good intentions, the regulations was in place to direct schools to raise that level of instruction. However, it has become overshadowed by NCLB and has become more of an unnecessary mandate that places undue burden on school districts, which cannot possibly be met with the high cost of energy, maintenance costs, shipping costs, etc., that was mentioned earlier. For small school districts that attempt to provide quality education by reaching high standards of accountability, business offices, administrators, maintenance personnel try numerous creative ideas to curtail and cut energy costs and maintenance costs to try to meet these extremely high expectations that, in my opinion, are very unrealistic for rural districts in today's educational program. In Annette Island School District, we hire outside consultants to make sure we address every conceivable way to meet the minimum expenditure requirement. And we have met it. We have been fortunate to meet the level in Annette Island these past couple of years due to our one-site REAA and our high-impact aid money that we received. But it took many hours of times and resources, and it's somewhat burdensome to try to meet it. I had been a superintendent in another rural district that couldn't make it. And we tried, we always felt that the idea was we try to improve every year. And being a believer in that, I think improvement, each year growth is very important, I finally realized it was totally unrealistic. And there was no way that that's real, that one single site was going to make it. And I want to kind of mention something that I think relates to this that Rich kind of spoke about. But while I was in Anchorage just last week and I attended the ACADECA academic decathlon and watched our kids excel and win 7 medals for participation, and Klawock was another school that did quite well. The coaches mentioned to me that it was the lowest turnout in the many years with many schools not able to send teams. And I kind of struggled with that a little bit, and I said, it may just be that they're finding ways to improve the minimum expenditure at the expense of programs. But at what cost? I had one of our students come up to me and said, she was the first year academic decathlete, and she says, I want to thank you for sending me to a place where kids think alike. I feel like I'm understood better. And I pondered that, and I said to myself, how many other sites that don't have the opportunity that we do to send kids to this are missing out to find a better place to express themselves and learn? And I went away from there very pleased to be invited to that and have the opportunity that few superintendents have taken to be able to pass out medals and recognize these kids that are future leaders of tomorrow, by the way. I sincerely hope that we are not forgoing quality programs or necessary maintenance to meet goals that can never be achieved, which may affect opportunities for kids. With the direction in reaching high standards of accountable education for all kids through the Congressional Act and NCLB, I assure you we're doing everything we can to meet and raise the bar for rigorous educational standards. We have to stay very focused because the stakes are high, and in reaching a standard by 2014 where every kid's going to not be left behind, I find that few will attain it. This is very similar and parallels the legislation. Therefore, I respectfully request repeal the unnecessary government oversight and allow us to focus on improving educational programs and facilities by reducing government bureaucracy. Leave it up to the local government bodies to decide. I believe that they will do the right thing, and I believe that we all have what our main focus is, and that's what's good for kids. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning and share this with you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Avery, and again, we really appreciate the work that you do and the school districts are doing for, you know, advancing achievement in the educational process. Are there questions for Mr. Avery? Representative Wilson?
Wilson had one for me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you could just answer those two questions for me.
Okay. Our board, I believe, is paid a monthly stipend of $109.
Okay.
Okay. They don't travel with their spouses, and that's not paid for. They put in countless hours of work. We just went through a very late night session of strategic planning that they don't get paid for. Yeah, we try to bring in a snack or two for them, but that's basically it. And I believe that the efforts that we've shown there is particularly because of their efforts, not because of mine, but because of what they've done. So I don't think that they're really paid to do anything. They put a lot of money back into fundraising activities in the school district, so most likely it's a wash.
Thank you. Representative Munoz.
Thank you.
Yes.
Is Annette Island a single-site district?
Yes, it is.
And could you tell me how many kids are?
Yes, 275 students. We approximately are very fortunate to have about 30 certificated staff. We have a principal in the high school, which is basically covers 712, and we have an elementary principal that covers K-6. They have been recognized as a Blue Ribbon School, and though we are making the effort not just to look at making AYP, we're trying to focus on the individual child and show growth each year because we feel that's more important. So our efforts are going to be this next coming year and the year after is to focus on those kids that quite aren't making that bar and hopefully get them to that level.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Keller?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just thinking about your $110 a month. You know, why would anyone do this? You know, a lot of work. But I was wondering, do you cover them on health and you know, is there a what the benefits the school district provides? And I was wondering, do you, I mean, I don't want not an yes. exact number, but your the line item, you know, for travel and you know, when you and how often do they travel, yeah. that kind of thing.
They go to one national school board association conference per year. They try to make it in the fly-ins, but we only maybe get one or two. They're all professionals. They're all working, so it's kind of hard for them to get away at times. I would say that they make every effort to make every meetings. We have very few that miss. They're very dedicated. I don't see that the amount, I think the travel money we put into them is appropriate due to the where we're located and the site we are, and where we have to go and the expenses that we incur. But we're not lavish there. We don't make it.
Follow up, Representative Keller.
I didn't mean to make an accusation.
Oh no, I.
Yeah, the. I was just. But how about benefits and retirement?
No, we do not pay any benefits. I believe there's language in there if they want to in their board policy. If they want to purchase it on their own, I think they're able to, but none of ours do.
Representative Keller.
I've always been very proud of the school board members in my district and any of them I've met. I mean, they are very dedicated folks.
Very dedicated.
I do not mean any dispersion.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I should kind of qualify why I'm asking that, because there are some school districts in this state that the board members get paid several thousand dollars a year, and their spouses are included. So I just was wondering how widespread that was. So that's why I'm asking the question. You know, $100 or even $200 doesn't bother me one bit. It's the ones that go way beyond that.
Well, I would just say that if we probably did that, we may have more people wanting the position.
<That's for sure.
coughs> and just for the committees, since we're on this topic, everybody should realize that when we did the retirement system rewrite, we changed it so that school boards have to make 24,000 dollars a year before they can before they qualify for retirement and health benefits PERS and the new PERS and TERS. So before there was the issue that a school district could pay a small amount and qualify people in PERS and TERS and incur a large future unfunded liability for the school district by having people qualify for a minimal wage but get PERS and TERS in the future, and that, you know, the legislature has done what it can to say that those benefits are only available if you're paying over $2,000 or $2,100, I forget the exact figure, per month to a school board member. And they have to justify that on their own and to their own communities and everything else. So just to put that on the record. So I think that that's some of what the question is being asked about, and that's why that's there. And there are large school districts in this in this state that do pay that amount, and there may be some small ones to pay that amount, but that really doesn't necessarily relate to the 70%, because some of those that make 70% also pay that amount to the board members. So,
and if you don't mind, I'll leave that out of my report to my school boards.
We don't mind at all. Let's see, we have are there any other questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Avery. And Jack Walsh. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Seaton and members of the committee. My name is Jack Walsh. I'm the superintendent of schools for the Bristol Bay School District in Southwest Alaska. And I won't use up your time with all the same things that you heard from my colleagues, although I would like to remind you that Bristol Bay, like them, is a small district in a small community. We serve the communities of South Naknek and King Salmon. We, in the last 2 years, have moved from 182 students in one count period down to 144 this past count period. So we're seeing some significant declining enrollments. And yet, in the history of Bristol Bay, that's something that happens every few years. That maybe 4 or 5 years, there's a cycle where we lose 15 to 20%. Last year, it was almost 25% of our population. And so those are things that, again, are probably tied to economics and lots of things. Undoubtedly, there will be parents and community members who will also say that they're concerned about the quality of the schools and the programs we can offer. As I am here to speak about the House Bill 147, I guess it's important to recognize that, you know, this 70-30 issue is one that I've followed for a long time in the state, not in Bristol Bay. I've worked down in Kodiak for a long time. And the idea of trying to make that 70-30 work has been a challenge, I think, for many districts. The numbers of waivers that you see annually is a concern for the department, a concern for the state board, and as well the legislators. Like the other two districts that just spoke, I'm proud of the fact that our school has always made the adequate yearly progress required under No Child Left Behind. And yet, I've only been there a year and a half. It was people like Woody Wilson and Richard Hebhardt and others who had been able to do that in those early years. But as I say that, I also have to be cautious that in a couple of years it's possible we won't make that. Again, with No Child Left Behind's bar increasingly going up, the numbers of students declining, and some of the other issues we're faced with, the likelihood is that many of the districts across the country will not make that adequate yearly progress when that margin of error becomes so small that every student has to be there. So I don't want you to think that if this bill changed in a year or two, people, you know, and your critics would say you should have never done that because now, look, they're not making adequate yearly progress. I don't necessarily see the two issues related, although I do think that student success and student progress is a greater indicator of our accountability and what we're doing in our communities than probably anything else. The couple things that I wanted to just say on behalf of Bristol Bay is that, you know, in the information that you have in your packet, it talks about how districts with $3 million budgets find this to be a very difficult task. Our budget is about $3.5 million, or it was a year ago, and we still have asked for a waiver every year that we, you know, this has been in existence. I don't think that we're not being careful about how we spend our money. I don't think that we're being wasteful in the ways that we do that. We operate a pretty small program with only 15 teachers. Two administrators that are certified, one full-time, one half-time, and then a small number of four people who are classified administrators who oversee things like our business office, our federal programs, and our building maintenance. And so, again, I think that we're doing what we can, but it's still a difficult thing. And as we talk about, you know, making 70% or not, most of the districts that don't make the 70% are in the low to mid 60% range, you know, that they're doing each year a real good effort to try to get closer and closer to 70%, I believe. There's a lot of other issues that I could mention. I think you've heard most of them from other people. Our fuel costs and the heating costs in our building now approximate more than 10% of our total budget. And when you consider that that's just to heat the building, you know, it's Bristol Bay at some point in time had more than 300 students. Now we have less than half of that. The facility hasn't changed. It's still a 90,000 square foot building out in a very remote area, you know. And when we operate vehicles to move kids on buses and transportation costs and everything else, again, we are still paying over $5 a gallon for a gallon of gas, where much of the state sees half that, you know, as their price. So. You know, we can't make a lot of apologies for that. That's just the state of affairs that we have to deal with. I do appreciate that as you ask questions about, you know, could we look at recalculating the instructional piece and leave energy off or do something else. It could change the numbers and it could make a difference, but I'm not sure that's the solution. I think the best solution may be that we repeal 147, and I appreciate your support towards that end. So.
And Jack, a question. I notice on the materials we have that was Agenda 5.5 from for the State Board of Education that you show 21% operation and maintenance on that's function 600 on that page. And I'm curious as to whether we, if you had a brand new school. Properly sized, if the state built a brand new school out there, insulated like we would today's standard, would the capital costs show up on this, and or would that just show up as a reduction in the operation and maintenance budget? Probably.
You know, I if I'm understanding the question correctly, I think that one of the things I would say is that there'd be some reduction in the operational costs and things, and it is something that might make a difference. The school, I have to tell you, is a you know, a older building. I've worked in Sandpoint, I've worked in Kodiak and around the villages there, and I know that it's one of the best maintained buildings I've ever seen. I do believe that, you know, when you talk about energy and alternative energy sources, we're a building that was built at a time that our building is entirely heated by waste heat and recaptured heat from the electric company. And so a challenge that we're seeing now is that, you know, I have no furnace, no boilers in my building. I don't buy diesel fuel to the extent that other people do. I pay somebody else to provide that. And so I think we're doing the right things to try to keep our costs down. And yet, as the old White Alice generators are being replaced by more efficient generators at the electric company, the waste heat isn't there in the way that it used to be. So there's a possibility that in the next few years I'm going to be looking for capital improvements that include the installation of boilers and things. But I apologize because I may have to contact your office later or just
And that's fine. You don't need to. I'm Eddie Jeans will be back at 9 and we can ask him. But I'm concerned that some of what we're seeing here is if we've got a 70-30 match or something like that, that for building new schools, that the new school and those costs, and or even if we're the rural areas where it's 100% on the state, those costs don't come in. But if it's an older school, then the operation and maintenance costs, of course, are higher, and they show up as this percentage that gets larger over time. So thank you. And you don't need to respond to Representative Wilson.
If you would answer the questions about the board members.
And I have to tell you, our board is paid a stipend of $50 per meeting, which generally speaking is one meeting per month for 9 or 10 of the months of the year. I will tell you that as the follow-up questions have gone around, I've thought about that. I believe that our board is a 5-member board that lives in the same town, you know, or in the same two towns, so they drive up and down the road. So there aren't travel costs as there might have been in other districts. They do attend or try to attend 2 fly-ins a year, although both years that I've been in the district, they've only attended 1. There's a 5-member board and a student representative. I know that the student representative doesn't get that monthly stipend. However, I do know that when we do go to a fly-in or they attend another meeting on behalf of the district, I believe that their per diem is $50 a day and the student per diem is slightly less than that. We just redid our board policy with the School Board Association, and I believe there's a policy that says if they would like to take our insurance, they're entitled to that. Our employees and the board then would pay 100% of that cost if they took health insurance. At this time, none of them choose to do that. And again, I have to tell you that you know, your comments and questions are important. These are people that work long hours, deal with very difficult situations, and I'd hate to try to factor out what their hourly wage was for the times when things are, you know, on a monthly basis they're being called.
Thank you. Representative Munoz has a question.
I was curious, is your administrative office in Naknek?
It is.
It is, okay.
And your next question is, where's the nearest administrative office of the school district? It's 12 miles down the road. Our office is over a garage barn that we have. We're right within 50 feet of the school district.
Okay. And my other question has to do with attracting and retaining teachers in your district, if that's an issue for Naknek.
It is. We're blessed. We're lucky that we have a high-performing school and a nice community to live in. We lack many of the infrastructure things that you see here or you know, the other kinds of sports in the community, theaters and restaurants and things like that would keep people in the community as well. And yet we have a great community for people to be in. I will tell you that last year we negotiated a 3-year contract with the teachers. And after, you know, watching negotiations for a lot of years in Kodiak and other places, we did, for the first time, provide a $1,500 moving allowance for our new hires, because it's hundreds of dollars. You know, I moved 30 miles further from Anchorage when I moved from Kodiak to Bristol Bay. The airfare is about almost twice what it is to go from Kodiak to go from Bristol Bay 30 miles further. And then the cost of all sorts of other things. Heating fuel is $6.50 a gallon still in our community. You know, when you're hiring a teacher at $40,000, you're asking them if they've got a family or anything, that this is a significant burden, I think, if we don't figure out some other things.
Mm-hmm. So, follow-up, Representative Munoz.
So in answer, I didn't quite hear the answer. Do you have difficulty retaining, or do they tend to stay?
We have about a 20% turnover. We lose in the area 3 or 4 teachers. In recent years, our big turnover has been administratively. Mm-hmm. Last year, the principal who made it through the whole year was the first one to do that in 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so we had 2 principals each of the 2 years prior to that. And this year, when she left in late July, we hired a teacher who had been there for the last decade, and he is now our half-time principal and teaches half-time.
Follow-up, Representative Munoz.
Last question. Do you encourage young people in your school system to go into careers in education so that they might come back and teach in their own home village?
We do, and we've seen a lot of our students become educators in Bristol Bay and in other parts of the region. We have one teacher who's lived in the community her entire life, been teaching and working in the school district for 38 years. We have several others who are born and raised in Alaska that have made a real difference on our staff. But we also have contributed to the teaching staffs all around the state because many of our former alumni are just people that wanted to be in Alaska and are making a difference. We're trying to start a new future Teachers of Alaska program, which has a lot of potential, we believe, as it's proven in other districts. And we also have just gotten involved with a grant with the Avant-Garde Foundation to encourage some of our aides and other people to become our future teachers, because we know that'll make a difference too.
Excellent. Thank you.
Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your opinion, has the 70% law on the books change the way the district has spent money in any way?
It has, because you know you had to take that seriously and you had to work to make that happen. And there are times where in some discretionary programs or in things where you're thinking about launching a new program or doing some major maintenance on a building or something, you've had a way whether or not that's going to help you to that end. A year ago when I wrote my first waiver, a year and a half ago, one of the concerns that the department had was we had dropped from about 64% of our budget to 62%, and they said, you need to change it. So I went, you don't just write it once and turn it in and expect it's going to fly through all the different people it has to. We've been sent them back several times asking to redo that. So again, in that situation, I had to change some budget line items and make sure that people understood that, yeah, my effort was going to be to at least maintain what we had committed in the past.
Thank you.
And can you follow up on that question? Just what were the kinds of things that you had to adjust on that? Was it maintenance? Was it not sending kids to academic decathlon? What kind of things happened?
Mostly in maintenance. I will tell you that for the last year and a half that I've been there, there's paint chipping off a couple walls that are building, and I was insistent we'd get it done the first summer I was there, and then we just had to put that on hold. And it's mostly maintenance pieces that we've set aside. I will tell you this, I am concerned as an educator about our reading performance and our writing performance, and like so many districts in the state, math is our lowest performance area. I'd like to bring in the specialists and the academic people to make a change there, but I really just struggled with, again, is somebody then going to say, you've already got a pupil-teacher ratio of one teacher for every 10 kids, can you really add more staff at that point? So,
okay, thanks. Representative Wilson, then Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and that's kind of what I was going to go into, is that I noticed that one of the other schools that spoke this morning, they had 30 teachers, but they don't have near the challenges that you do because they're close to transportation, and because if you want to send the kids out to do any kind of activity, that costs money. Now, do they have to raise that themselves? Does the school provide it? How does that work?
We put $40,000 aside in our budget of $3.5 million for student activity travel, and then there's other money to support the sponsors and the other kinds of events. But I would guess on an annual basis, our students and their families collectively raise in excess of $40,000 to make that work. And again, that's an area where the plane tickets haven't gotten cheaper, the charters haven't gotten cheaper. We don't have other towns we can drive down the road and play. So like Juneau and so many other places, all of our trips involve air travel, and that's a costly way to do it. Again, those have been reduced in ways that, some people have wondered and questioned whether or not that's in the kids' best interest. And I have to think about that, too, from time to time.
Representative Keller.
If you brought in a reading specialist in a program where you changed from a 10-to-1 to an 8-to-1, that would actually improve your instructional component. I mean, you would actually be in better shape, as far as the meeting that 70-30 than you would if you didn't do that, right? I just want to make sure I understood.
You're absolutely correct, and I apologize that may have been a bit of a bird walk.
That's all right. I mean, and I in fact, I
Representative Keller.
I really appreciate in your desire to actually affect the reading level of the children. That's sincere. Thank you.
And I guess the follow-up question on that, the stimulus for doing that is, I mean, of course it's consideration of the kids, but the measurement tool, the accountability tool is AYP. And, yeah, I mean, is that?
That's correct. I mean, our school report card has to reflect our progress there.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Herbert? Is it Herbert?
No, Jack Walsh.
Oh, sorry. I got the wrong check. Thank you, Jack, Mr. Walsh. Mr. Walsh, go ahead.
Chairman Seaton, I just had one last thing that I wanted to. I'm going to leave for a meeting, and I appreciate your time. But I did want you to know that while I won't be here during the talks about House Bill 58, I do support the idea that we consider that student loan forgiveness for people working in our field. I think it's critical to our work in education throughout the state. So.
Okay, well, thank you for that, too.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And we appreciate all the superintendents that are meeting here taking their time to come over. I know it's breaking their meetings. We have Dave Herbert or Hebert? I'm not sure which it is. Would you come?
Herbert.
Morning. Would you go ahead and identify yourself and who you represent for the record?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I am Dave Herbert. I'm the superintendent of St. Mary's School District, located in southwestern Alaska on the Yukon River. I'm here today to talk with you about the 70-30 rule, and I'll try not to to restate too many of the common threads you're hearing about the 70-30 rule this morning, but I do want to impress upon you some of the burden that the 70-30 rule places on a school district. First, let me start with telling you, St. Mary's School District has met AYP. We're at level zero, which is the best rating that you can have as a district in the state of Alaska as far as meeting AYP. We have approximately 185 students, 14 certified teachers, one principal, and myself are the administrative team. We have a part-time business manager. Some of the factors that affect us, first before I get into the burdens, are, you know, we receive fuel one time a year. We get a delivery in the summer. Okay, we all know what the fuel prices were like this summer. When they offload heating fuel, unleaded fuel, we are stuck with those fuel prices for the remainder of the school year. Right now, a gallon of unleaded gas is $6.41 in St. Mary's, and heating fuel is even higher. So we also are a single-site school district. We're a first-class city, and our budget is under $3 million, approximately $2.8 million. We have continuously written. I've been there 4 years. This is my fourth year in St. Mary's, and every year we have to write a letter requesting a waiver. Now, with all due respect, I'm the superintendent hired to run the district. We have a school board that reviews very carefully all the expenditures of the district at each meeting. They're paid, I'll wait for that, they're paid $100 per meeting, just so you understand that. We have an outside auditing firm that audits our finances. Our meetings are open to the public, and it takes quite a bit of effort to write this letter, produce the numbers, and submit them each year. For a small school district with M&O above 20% a budget less than $3 million, we're not going to meet the 70-30 rule. We are educating children to the best of our ability, and I do feel that the decisions that are made on how to expend the funds that are given to the district by the state should rest in the hands of the district and the governing board, and we are very frugal with the funds We don't travel all over the place. Our board travels down to the Alaska Association School Board fly-ins and occasionally to hire teachers when needed, because we serve a very unique student population and they want to have some input on who's teaching their children. So I just want to throw a couple other things out there. I don't know that there, and Eddie Jeans would probably be the one to speak to this, I don't know that there's ever been one waiver that's been rejected. Okay. The state looks at our budget every time that we submit our budget. It's scrutinized by the state very carefully, and so it is an additional burden. This year there was some additional questions that were required and of our district, and of course we supplied those, but it's very time consuming for myself, my business manager, my school board, to write these waivers. And we feel that we are very frugal, that we expend the funds in the best way that we see fit to educate the children that we serve in St. Mary's. So just wanted to impress upon you that it is not just a letter that we just write freely write, and it's takes, you know, 20 minutes and we submit it. And so
thank you very much, Mr. Herbert. Is there any questions? Representative Keller.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You say none of the waivers have ever been rejected, and that this year you had some additional questions. I would enjoy hearing what the additional questions were that you had to answer, and if you be careful, by the way, the department has moved in behind you. But have you ever felt like harassed by the department? I mean, not harassed may be the wrong word, but I mean the burden, just describe that level of frustration and burden you have.
And again, I'll for the record, I stated that Eddie Jeans would have the answer whether or not a waiver has ever been rejected. There were additional questions in relation to the waiver and the way that it was laid out this year, and I'm not, maybe the department can expand on why that change occurred from the format in the past. And there were some additional questions asked, I think, by the state board on board expenditures specifically, and that was for, I believe, all single-site school districts. There were a few that had some additional work that they had requested. So they approved the waiver and then requested some additional information on board expenditures. And I'll let the department tell you why that occurred.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate your time. Do we have anyone else to offer public testimony at this time? Is there anyone online? None. Seeing none, I'll close public testimony. And we are going to, let's see, I think we'll put this aside for a few minutes and take up HB 58. I know that Mr. Jeans has come, but we've had, on this bill, but we've had Representative Thomas here for a while to present HB 58. So I think we'll take that up and we'll just put this, we'll just table 147 for a few minutes, but we have completed public testimony, but we will be getting the department up soon. Welcome to Education Committee. Sorry our numbers are a little bit small this morning. We have people from press availability and other meetings, so.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question, I guess, you don't even have enough to move the adopt the CS then, do you?
Can we move the CS?
We can, we can adopt CS for consideration.
Want to move it?
Sure.
Okay. I'd like to move CS for House Bill 58, number 26-LS0307/P.
And that is adoption for a working draft, not for moving the bill. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And I'm going to object for discussion. And would you, before we adopt the CS, would you go through the changes from the original bill to the CS?
Okay. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Representative Thomas from District 5. With me is my staff, Casey Schroeder-Hotch, and we appreciate you hearing this and hearing the CS. We have a little blurb in front of here, page here, showing the changes made to HB 58. The main changes were in Section 5. We changed the eligibility criteria. When we started this bill, Mr. Chairman, we looked at biologists and education. Dentists came along. They wanted to be put on there. Then we had nurses that wanted to be put on there. So we looked around and said that we would change the whole criterion on this and let the Department of Labor determine what needs are there and who needs what profession we need. So we changed that in the residency and the applicant working in Alaska, applicant being working in designated field in Alaska within 4 years after attaining his or her degree, then they must have received a student loan from Alaska. That was the big changes, allowing the Department of Labor to determine what fields will go out and solicit for.
Okay.
Two main ones.
Thank you. Questions about CS?
Representative Munoz. So a student starts to school and they're involved in an area that has a critical shortage in Alaska for workforce shortage. At what they graduate and then they have 4 years to come back to the state. At what point do they become eligible for this reimbursement? Are they eligible as a student or they're not eligible until they come back? And then what if the workforce changes and it's no longer a critical need area? That was,
for the record, Casey Schroeder-Hotch, staff representative Thomas. The student becomes eligible when they come back to Alaska, work in Alaska in a designated area, so then they can apply for the program. And the intent is that if they've applied, their application's been accepted, that they would be grandfathered in until their loan was paid off. But if the next year something happens and it changes dramatically, they wouldn't be suddenly cut off, you know. But you can talk to the Department of Labor about that, but it's not likely to change that dramatically in those short years.
So the student can contact Department of Labor to determine what the career opportunities are, but it's not until they return that they're actually eligible for reimbursement.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Are there any further questions on the adoption of the CS?
Yes,
please. Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if it's for the sponsor or the committee, but do we have a fiscal note with this, the bills? I didn't see any in my packet. I might have just missed it. And of course, the question is whether or not the fiscal note reflects the CS.
The Chair, Representative Keller, there is a fiscal note from the Alaska Student Loan Corporation, and it does not reflect the CS.
Thank you.
And if we adopt the CS, we will get a fiscal note tailored to the CS. Are there further questions about the CS and adopting the CS as our working document? Seeing no further questions, I'm going to remove my objection, and so we have adopted the CS as our working document. And that's 26LS0307/P. Welcome. Now, would you go ahead and present the bill to us?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for adopting the CS. Also, thank you for your time this morning. The primary reason that we sponsored HB 58 was because I've chaired the Fish and Game Subcommittee for 2 years now, and each year they come in and say they have lack of biologists, so we thought, well, we'll put a bill in there, and that morphed because as I talked to other legislators, they had nursing concerns, as you can figure out who that was, and I talked to the chairman, he had a concern with DNR, not scientists, but foresters, and so we said, okay, we'll change the intent of this bill. Now, the true intent of this bill is that every time one of our students or our children leave Alaska, they don't come home. We want them to come home and work and stay here. Now, those of us who've been here for a long time look around and see our neighbors. Our neighbors work in Alaska for 30 years, and they retire. They stay here. They move out to Mendenhall Valley, or they move into a smaller home. But I've got my uncles who have worked in the school system for 25 and 30 years, and I see some of my old basketball coaches yet here they take maybe a month off and leave and come back, but they spend their whole life in Alaska, and that's what we're trying to get at, Mr. Chairman, is have a student get their education, return home, and we have incentives for them to come back and work with them. You know, if you work in a rural part of Alaska with the necessary need, we retire 25% of your student loan debt from Alaska per each year. Now, if you move in, if you're doing it in an urban area, it's 6 years, and again, it's because the costs are less, and you heard the gentleman before us, it's an incentive to keep the students back into the rural parts of Alaska. I told my staff before I ran in here that it was going to run off, but we wanted to point out that we have a workforce development that we're getting ready for the gas pipeline, and I believe that's between $6 to $8 million a year that we're spending, somewhere around that. If you look at the different pots of money for union development in different trades that we're getting ready for, but we had no incentive for a college student to leave. They wanted to point out that the records show that a college student will make $1 million to $1.5 million more than people who don't have a college degree. Again, knowing the future of Alaska, we want those people to retire in Alaska and keep their money here. I think we had a repayment program at one time, and I don't know how it worked. I think I've heard criticism that we have the leanest or weakest repayment schedule. If you don't pay it, they kind of just let you go and walk away from the loan without foreclosing. I'm hoping that this will revitalize it, but the students hopefully will learn a little bit of responsibility and come back and make payments on the loan and live here. I think that I met with the Doctors Association the other day, and there's the age of doctors now. They're aging and they're not coming back here because they were saying it's when you come back to Alaska and you have a student loan, it's like having a mortgage on your first home already. You're in debt $200,000 to $300,000, and if you come back to Alaska, the job opportunities, you start at a lower schedule and work your way up, but you can make your student loan payments if you're out of Alaska. So I think every position that we are trying to bring back here, you know, through the incentive program will work, whether it be teachers or doctors, lawyers, and Indian chiefs. So. But anyway, I appreciate your I do appreciate your listening to the bill, and maybe next time we bring it up, we can move it. But I know the fiscal note is high, Representative Keller. It starts at $2 million, but again, I'm pointing out that I believe our workforce development is around $6 million to $8 million. And the fiscal note, even though it's outdated, shows that by 2015, it will have gone six times the amount that we have today, which means to me that you have more students coming home. And I think they projected in FY10, if we adopted this program, you'd have 419 participants, and in 2015, 2,500. So we would no longer be exporting our students that we're training in to become professionals. We would be bringing them home. I've got to go get briefed for another meeting. So if you have any more questions.
Thank you. We appreciate you coming down and presenting the bill, and we can follow up with Casey on other questions unless someone has a specific question for you. I don't see any, so thank you very much for coming down.
Members. Thank you.
And we've had Representative Guerra join us. Representative Guerra, if you'd like to take a chair up here at the table, we have room today. Appreciate it. Questions for the bill sponsor on any of these items? Yes, Representative Munoz.
Thank you. I'm curious about the dividend that can be paid back from the corporation. Is that based on other operations of the corporation, or just in relationship to the funds generated through this program?
Through the chair, the Representative Munoz, are you referring to Section 4?
Yes.
Yes. That's actually language that's already in statute.
Okay.
Apparently, the corporation can pay back the money to the state if they have extra money. And the new language is the bold and underlined language, and it just says that money can be paid to the new program if they want to.
And so is my understanding that this is the repayment on capital, basically, that the state of Alaska originally invested in the Student Loan Corporation, and as it gets interest from loans that are above its operating expenses, it pays some of that back, and this just designates that instead of just coming to the general fund, it could also be made available for the this repayment right now?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Representative Munoz.
Is that the area that you're looking at primarily for funding the program, or are you also looking for capitalization from the legislature?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, this fund will have to be capitalized. It's going to consist of appropriations made by the legislature.
Okay. And
now, Representative Munoz.
Do you have a recommended amount of that capitalization?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, we would at least like to be able to get through the first year. And since I don't have a fiscal note for the CS sitting in front of me, I'd have to speculate maybe $6 million. But I would want to defer to the department on that.
Okay, fine. And when we're talking about capitalization, just to be clear, we're not talking about capitalizing a separate fund. We're talking about an appropriation, GF appropriation, to fund the repayment of these loans. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Just want to make sure that I'm understanding as well. Yes, Representative Keller.
Well, I have to present bills. I hate this kind of question, so I'm sorry. Could you show me in the bill? Is this for a residence, number one, and number two, are we putting ourselves in a situation where we're paying a loan repayment for another post-secondary outside of the state? I don't think so. Can you show me where that is in the bill?
Yes, to the chair, Representative Keller. The residency requirement is on page 3, lines 27 and 28, that you had to be a resident of the state at the time of submitting the application. And then on the next page, on page 4, you have to remain in the state working during the repayment period. But I would point out that you also have an amendment sitting in front of you to remove this residency requirement. Because after discussing with the department, the Student Loan Corporation can only deal with residents or people who are not residents who are in the state going to school. And those are the only two kinds of people that they can deal with. So if we remove this requirement, those are the only two kinds of people that we would be able to be eligible for the program. And the thing was pointed out to me that if we require them to be a resident, that means that if they go out of state to go to school, come back and get a job, there's a grace period, a penalty phase, basically, where they would not be eligible for the program until they got their residency back.
Follow-up, Representative Keller.
You did better on that response than I would have if I was. That's very well done. Thank you.
Let's see. Other questions? I guess, as I'm understanding, on page 3, line 6, so the loans that could be repaid are repayment of educational loans from the corporation under the program, so that as I'm understanding this would not pay back student or have us funding student loans that were given by California or Wisconsin or some other state or any other entity or private entities.
No, the student has to get a loan from the Alaska Student Loan Corporation.
Okay, and it's not only that they had to get a loan, but any loans that are being paid back are the loans from the corporation. I just want to make that clear because if you had loans from there and loans from others, the loan repayment is only the loan that come through the Alaska Student Loan Corporation. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. We had in the CS, we were changing the eligible criteria. And could you just, I know Senator or Representative Thomas went over that a little bit, but could either of you go over those criteria and what has been the change from the original and what was the justification for that?
No problem. The eligibility criteria begins on page 3. We're requiring them to be a resident of the state, and that's the same. And on number 2, we inserted a 4-year time requirement because we don't want them to get their degree and then stay down south for 10 years and then decide to come back. We want them to come back immediately. We did give them a 4-year grace period to begin working in their chosen field because some degrees require you to be licensed, and sometimes that takes time. So we thought that within 4 years, you should be able to get licensed. You have to remain employed in Alaska. You must have gotten a loan from the Alaska Student Loan Corporation. That was a new one. We inserted that to make that very clear that you can't be getting a loan from Wells Fargo. And then the Department of Labor would be determining where there are shortages in the state, and that would be how we would be determining the eligibility criteria for that. There was one change in the conditions and limitations on loan repayments. That's the payment back schedule.
Can you pull that mic just a little closer?
Oh, sorry. So there was one change in the conditions and limitations on the loan payments, and that's the payback schedule, the 4 years for the rural and the 6 years for the urban. What we did is we made absolutely clear that if the student is gone for 4 years and has to start paying back the loan and they do that on their own, we're not going to be paying them back for that. So any payments that the student makes on their own before they apply for this program is not reimbursable. So that's the change there.
So the question is, somebody takes a job outside and works in and makes their student loan payments and then decides to come back, they could get what is remaining on the student loan, but they wouldn't get reimbursed for the payments they made while they were working outside or occupied at it.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. And I guess, can you talk about the two different repayment rates for the rural and non-rural?
Basically, it's 4 years if you work in a rural area, and so that would be 25% each year. And then 6 years if you work in an urban area, and that's 16.67% each year.
And was the basis for that the higher expenses or trying to encourage more in rural Alaska, or what was kind of the basis for that?
Well, rural areas tend to be deficient in professionals, and we want to attract professionals to return to rural areas. And, you know, it's because of costs and remoteness and the challenges that go along with that people tend not to want to move to rural areas. But getting your loan payback in 4 years is a huge incentive. It would be a huge incentive for me to move to a rural area.
Okay. And so we've had testimony before about the problem of retaining teachers in rural Alaska and that the high turnover has been. So you see this repayment schedule as a way to help maintain those teachers in rural Alaska. I know we've had a great improvement over time here in our retention of teachers within Alaska, but it hasn't always been there. So this is to try and maintain that in rural Alaska.
Yeah, and you granted 4 years is relatively quick, but the deal is that if we can get them out there and make them stay there for 4 years, that we think that they would tend not to leave immediately. They may leave eventually, but may not immediately.
Great. Representative Book. Oh, and before we go forward, I wanted to recognize that Representative Book and Representative Gardner have joined us, and they've been with us for pretty much the entire bill. Representative Book.
Before we get beyond page 4, section B, lines 7 through 11, I noticed that this was one of the components, legislative aid, Casey, that you mentioned. Is that correct, that you're talking about the Department of Labor and Workforce Development? They're the ones that are going to be denoting these occupations. Do we have a list? I mean, this is a rather vague stipulation here as to which of these occupations are, shortage of qualified employees. And I was just wondering if we have a means by which we can identify some of the people that are going to be, making application for this particular loan.
Through the chair, Representative Book, there's no list per se, but there are several factors that the Department of Law tracks to determine the future needs of the state, areas that were deficient, and they update their studies about every 1 to 2 years, and we do have somebody from the Department of Labor here that can talk in detail about what they do. And they publish this magazine, Economic Trends, periodically. I think it's like every month. So that's also another way to see what the needs of the state would be.
Rep. Boop.
Through the chair, that's rather vague. And, you know, we're going through some very specific requirements in this bill. And to give us an outline in the legislation of itself, I would hope that we could clear that up. And we have some very specific components of this legislation. However, it's wrapped around something to me that's very vague. And so I'm having a real difficult time with that.
Thank you, Representative Book. And would you identify yourself for the record and go ahead?
My name is Hannah Harrison. I'm an intern for Representative Seaton. I'm kind of shadowing Casey on this one. It's part of my senior thesis project as a student at UAF. But through the chair, Representative Book, this bill originally addressed nursing education and a lot of the natural sciences. It very specifically laid out occupations in limnology, forestry, soil sciences. I believe natural resource management was one of the potentials to be included. There was quite a list going as far as the natural sciences were concerned. It was at that point that Casey and Representative Thomas decided that it was perhaps beyond our ability as staffers and legislators to really determine what the best occupations were to include in the bill, and thus it was determined that the Department of, the Labor and Workforce Development should be in charge of kind of determining those things. But to kind of help you clarify, part of the research we did was asking the state what occupations really have high vacancy, and in the past high vacancy has been defined as 15% or more, but I won't say that that's for sure. I'll let the department speculate on that. That a lot of those occupations came in as in the department of, or excuse me, in the field of natural resource management, in the field of forestry in particular, a lot of wildlife and wildland and fire technicians, a lot of positions that are not necessarily entry level, but definitely after having earned a bachelor's degree and having a few years of experience in the field. I believe a biologist 1 and 2 and a biologist 3 were real high demand within fisheries, just as an example. It's not difficult to determine what all of those positions are. They do exist within the data that we have now, and we can certainly provide that for you and kind of clarify specifically what we're addressing through this bill.
Through the chair,
Representative Book.
Didn't help. It's not clear in the bill, and the criteria here established through 1443-830 gives a list, and I'm sure that if we follow the statute, it's pretty much what's in the statute that we're looking at here. However, the actual jobs that we're talking about are not a component of this bill, and so I would be looking for clarity there. So,
okay. Thank you, Representative Book, and I understand what you're asking for is not just identification of jobs, but identification of majors, if that's what we're working on. And we'll have them get back to us in writing with that answer. One other question is, how is that balanced in the program that's being put out if we don't identify certain, you know, nurses, biologists, you know, those certain categories, and the department changes from month to month? Maybe this is a better question for post-secondary commission, but how do they determine who on an ongoing basis qualifies? Is it when you initially applied and it was there, you get that for the 4 years, even if the job requirement has dropped off the list? Is it only, you only get reimbursed while that job is on there? I'm trying to figure out how that works. Do you have an answer to that? If you don't, that's fine. You can get back to us.
Mr. Chairman, the intent is that it, at the time of the application, that they, once they were got accepted into the program, they would be eligible for repayment, even if their degree dropped off. And I can work with the department. If that's not absolutely clear in the bill, we can insert language to make it absolutely clear.
Okay, or you could, if you can point to me where that It is clear. If it's not clear in the bill, then yes. Would you work with the department to get that clarified? One of the things we want to do is make sure that, you know, our law, that everybody understands our law when they're making an application, is what they would qualify for or not qualify for. So thank you on that. Are there further questions about qualification for HB 58? Representative Munoz.
No, I agree with the points that have been made just now. I think it's important to have some flexibility in the department because there are changing needs as we go forward. But I do think it's important to have kind of a dependability or clarity in the law. Are we looking at the top 10 professions? Are we look for, where we have needs, or is it a percentage of vacancies? Or, I think that is very important.
So the chair, Representative Munoz, the way the bill is drafted right now, it would be the entire list. So it would be very, very expansive.
Yes.
And I agree with you that it is vague, but we didn't list things in the bill because once you start listing things in a bill, it becomes Christmas treed and it's very political. We wanted actual numbers and actual studies to be able to back up what we'd be putting on the list. Mm-hmm. And they can change that through regulation, and that's why we didn't identify things in the bill directly.
Thank you. Representative, does that answer your question? Mm-hmm. Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then what can you describe, or is the Department of Labor here to describe the process for specifying an occupation field? That, is that process easily described somewhere?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I believe it's very complex, and I'd rather defer to the department on that one. They are here.
Okay, any other questions for the sponsors? Thank you very much. I think, as we're knowing, we're not moving this bill today. We have work to do on it, and we appreciate those. We have, for the committee's information, we have Ryan Keith from Department of Labor and Workforce Development here or online, and we have Diane Behrens here for questions. Do either of you have anything that you want to add other than for questions at this time as far as testimony goes? Go ahead and come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Diane Behrens, Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education. Just in response to the general discussion regarding prioritization, as a longtime program administrator, I think it's often helpful to have either a very clear record of the intent of legislation or actual language in the statute, so that a state agency is not put in a position of issuing regulations which can be described as materially changing the program or the results of the program. So one of the concerns I have, and I've shared with Casey and appreciate being in the conversation, is unless we anticipate a full funding of this program, having to make administrative decisions about which occupations we're providing benefits to while others are not, which areas of state potentially might be receiving a greater focus when there's not necessarily a statewide shortage, but a maldistribution. Education is one of those areas where while there may not be a shortage in South Central Alaska broadly, there may be a shortage across all areas of teaching in the rural areas. So I think some language that would allow us to impose certain principles, whether that's a public interest emphasis or a workforce emergency workforce needs emphasis, something that would allow us to make those decisions or even to inform regulation drafting to further implement the program would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And Diane, would you mind working with the sponsors of the bill to get us some kind of draft ideas? I mean, they don't have to be the final ones. There could be two or three different ones, but then we would at least have language to to debate instead of just trying to come out of it de novo. But I appreciate that comment. Is there anything further, Diane, at this time?
Thank you.
And are there, let's see, Brian Keith, did you wish to? Welcome. Would you identify yourself for the record?
For the record, I'm Bryn Keith, and I'm the Research Chief for the Department of Labor's Workforce Research and Analysis Section. And I'm here to talk about the data requirements of HB 58. And regrettably, the Department of Labor doesn't have a handy list of shortage occupations. Shortage requires understanding the demand for an occupation and the supply of individuals who are skilled in that occupation. We have lots of information on the demand. We know how many carpenters an employer needs, employers throughout the state, how many physicians are needed, but we don't know how many people there are in our labor market residing in Alaska who have those skills. So in order to really assess a shortage, we come up short. We have some proxy measures, which I think are pretty good. One that we use for policy is the number or percentage of non-residents by occupation in the state. Now, there may be many reasons an employer hires a non-resident, but one of the reasons is a lack of skilled Alaskans to take those positions. And that data we release every January. We produce it every year. We also we project future demand by occupations. And that's where we're trying to get a handle on where will there be a shortage based on an increase in need for workers, again, putting aside the question of is there an adequate pool of Alaskans to take those jobs. But every 2 years, we do a forecast of future occupational demand. And the one on the street we just issued about 2 months ago is out to 2016. And I think that's a very good measure of potential shortage. You know, I'm in the precision business. I'm not going to say it is a shortage, but it gives you an indicator of a potential shortage. Mm-hmm. So we look in those data sets not just at growth, but the need to replace workers who would be retiring from the occupation, because, again, that's a lot of where, if there is a shortage, if that friction occurs in the labor market, it's going to happen as there are people leaving permanently the occupation, as well as increased demand based on economic growth. So I don't know if that's helpful. It's a difficult question. We've never been able to definitively answer it at the Department of Labor. We just don't have that data set that really targets that. But I think we have some measures that can be helpful.
And I guess as a committee chair looking at this bill, trying to get our hands around it, can you and the Commission on Post-Secondary Education and the sponsors of the bill just have a little round table and come together with some written statement of what you see as the useful way for us to identify those occupations or those fields of study and the pros and cons of different measurements that we or different lists or different mechanism that we could use for arriving at that for reimbursing Alaska student loans and those qualifications. That'd be helpful. I mean, talking is not quite like having, and it doesn't have to be a, you know, really deeply edited, but if we can have some pros and cons in paper, then that would give the committee a lot more meat to grab on to as far as how we would like to look at that instead of addressing it off the cuff.
Certainly.
I appreciate that. Are there questions? Representative Keller.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to confirm that I heard you right, that the Department of Law does not do any prioritizing. You identify potential shortage areas, but you don't do anything with your data sets that shows that this particular location is critical, more critical than this critical one. You know, there's no prioritization, right?
Through the chair, the research and analysis section does not prioritize occupations based on those criteria. The Workforce Investment Board, however, is looking at prioritizing occupations for various reasons, largely funneling training dollars. But again, the research section produces the data on which those policy decisions could be made.
Thank you.
And hopefully that can be part of that discussion and little white paper. Are there other questions for Brim? I'm sorry for misreading your name.
Not a problem.
Seeing none, thank you again. Since we just adopted the CS today, we'll hold public testimony for the next time we can have the bill, because the public hasn't been able to see the amount of the CS. So at this time, unless anyone has any other questions, we'll put HB 58 away, awaiting some further information on it, and another fiscal note designed around the CS that we adopted. And we do have Eddie Jeans here, so we're going to take back up off the table HB 147. And Eddie, would you come forward? Well, we had the public testimony today on this bill. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance for the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development. I understand you took up House Bill 147.
We did, and we had testimony from four superintendents of school boards, and we have in our packet the resolution passed by the state school boards asking that this asking that the 70% requirement be withdrawn. Would you go ahead and give us a little bit of a overview of the why the department feels that the 70% is no longer needed, and what other assessment tool better serves? Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The 70% requirement for instruction was passed back in 1998 when the state was first starting its accountability system. And this was a way to focus school district expenditures on instructional programs. At that time, the legislature also passed the first of our state assessment system, which we would measure student proficiencies in grades 3, 6, and 8. I believe 3, 6, and 8. Since then, under NCLB, we've expanded that to grades 3 through 10. So we're measuring students' proficiency levels on an annual basis in reading, writing, and math. And we can look at an individual school's growth in student performance from year to year. And we believe that that's a better measure of a school or a school district's success, is increasing student proficiency or student achievement. So we believe that that's a better system. As you know, we have school districts in this state that have 55,000 or approximately 55,000 students, clear down to one that has 15, I believe. So to suggest that all districts can meet the 70% requirement simply doesn't work. We've identified two specific areas: those school districts that have a budget of $3 million or less, a total operating budget of $3 million or less, and those school districts that spend 20% or more on operation and maintenance. And usually those are your large, very dispersed public school districts. I think we've done what we can with this particular piece of legislation. We have nice uniformity in the financial reporting. We will continue to review audits and budgets for that uniformity, and we think it's run its life. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there questions for Eddie? Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The instructional component that is required, that ties with the 30%, where and how is that defined? And is it reviewed? And I haven't been able to find any concise definition anyway, but that doesn't mean it isn't there. I just haven't found it.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I believe the definition is in regulation, and it specifies the categories of expenditure requirements, like instruction, special education, support services, and I believe the other one is school operations. There it is, instruction, school administrative supports. I'm sorry, instruction. I have it in here somewhere. But it is set out in regulation, and when we adopted the categories that we would be measuring on an annual basis, those are what we understood the legislature to mean as instructional expenditures. And I'd be happy to get the regulation for you.
Representative Keller, follow up.
Just so it is possible that you could go back in and review those elements of the definition to perhaps include like, for example, the fuel cost is the one we heard this morning, you know, that has gone so high in some of our rural areas. And let me reword that a little bit. If a school district were to apply to you now and declare that part of their increased or part of their heating cost was part an instructional component, would that be a valid consideration for the waiver?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, that's an excellent example of why a district would require a waiver. But there again, I think you're gonna find that we've established a pattern. Those school districts with a budget, small budget, $3 million or less, basically they don't have the economies of scale to meet the 70% requirement. Those districts that have multiple sites typically are the ones that spend 20% or more on operation and maintenance, and those will be the ones that are asking for a waiver on a reoccurring basis.
Representative Keller.
One quick follow-up. We've heard testimony this morning of the fact that it's very significant amount of work that's tied into getting these waivers, and yet I've also heard, you know, that it was a letter, and I understand you're going to supply a zero fiscal note, and so does that imply that the level of the EED, the workload there for this waiver, how high is it? Is it insignificant as far as a fiscal impact issue?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, we are going to provide a zero fiscal note for this particular legislation. The amount of scrutiny that we're going to conduct on our budget reviews will continue to be very high level and require substantial amounts of time. What we won't be doing is when districts submit their waiver letters to us, we won't have that additional dialogue with districts to justify their waiver request, to put it in a readable format that we present it to the State Board of Education. So the overall reduction in effort from our part is minimal. Although I would say that the school districts, they spend a considerable amount of time in preparing these waiver requests.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may mention, I believe Dave Herbert was one of the testifiers.
That is correct.
When I came in from St. Mary's. See, he's a prime example. Their school district, their students are performing very high, yet he has to request a waiver on an annual basis. It just doesn't make any sense that he has to go through that process when their students are some of the I don't want to say highest performing, but they're performing very well. And so that's the measure that we should be using, is how well are the students performing, not did he spend enough money in instruction.
And Mr. Jeans, we've passed legislation that allows, if they're not meeting success with students, we have new ability of the department to go in and work with those districts. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely correct. With the passage of Senate Bill 285 last year, it not only gave the department the authority, but the directive to work with schools and school districts that are low performing on a reoccurring basis.
And Mr. Deans, one of the questions that was brought up, I know you weren't here, but was brought up was to all the four that testified, was about the board members' pay, travel with spouses, and that kind of thing, and whether that was a problem. And do you have, does this provision give you that oversight that you wouldn't have otherwise? What I'm trying to do is figure out, if this goes away, do you lose any oversight capability for those things that you might determine, you might not, but you might determine would be not promoting student achievement?
Thank you for the question, Mr. Chairman. I do have some opinions about that. First of all, the legislation is very straightforward. It says either they meet the 70% or they don't, and if they don't, they request a waiver. It doesn't give us any gray area to say how close are you to 70%. And typically what's happened is we hear some information about some school districts that have spent money maybe inappropriately. But this is not the mechanism in which to address those issues. The place to address those issues is through whether or not their students are achieving. If their students are not achieving, then we can go in and ask the hard questions, and we can say, no, you can't spend your money on that anymore. That's inappropriate, and we want you to direct more of your resources to instruction. So under the current law, I don't think we really have any flexibility to say that was an inappropriate use of funds. I think under 285, once we've determined that a school is low performing or a district, that clearly gave us the authority to tell districts that's an inappropriate use of funds.
Okay, are there other questions for Eddie Jeans on this?
And Mr. Chairman, I think I did hear somebody say that waivers have always been granted or there haven't been any denied. And that statement's true, partially. The department has recommended to the state board that they not grant a waiver, I believe, in two, maybe three instances. The superintendent of those individual schools came before the state board and pleaded their case beyond the written waiver request and made certain assurances to the state board that they would do certain things to get their waiver granted. So the department takes our responsibility under this piece of legislation very, very seriously. And when districts cannot demonstrate to us through the written documentation that it's a cause beyond their control, we have gone to the state board and recommended they do not grant the waiver.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess that one of the testifiers did say that when you when they applied for their waiver, that it was sent back and said you really need to do a little more adjusting, and then they sent it again. How often does that happen? That you know that you send it and then they send it back, and then they do a little more figuring, and then they send it and you accept it.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, the waiver has to match what their budget tells us, and if they're telling us a different story in their waiver request than what the budget's telling us, then absolutely we have to have that exchange. We also have to have that exchange if I get a letter that looks identical to the one the year before but different dates. We take this charge very seriously, and we're not just going to rubber stamp the request. Even though we've identified those two categories, we know they're going to ask for a waiver, but we want them to explain why they need the waiver, and it can't be the same response year after year.
Okay, I guess the question is, we have a request, a resolution, I think this is the second one from the state school board asking that this requirement be gone. We have the Department of Education saying that this has been superseded by better management tools and better assessment tools. We have the school board administrators have requested that it be removed to the association. We have the all the superintendents that have testified that the tool is not working. Do we have any other questions that we would like to ask Mr. Jeans about this? Representative Munoz.
Are you ready for a motion?
Representative Keller.
That was a great lead-in there, Chair Seaton. So here I am in front of the freight train. I'm going to object and vote no when a motion is made, but I want to explain myself a little bit.
Representative Keller.
Yes.
Shall
we wait for the objection? Okay.
Unless you were requesting that it be held for amendment. I mean.
Yes, I would like to make that request. On a comment on that is that I would like to see us look into adjusting the requirement, maybe refining the instructional component definition that's in statute to key, so as an alternative to just simply repealing the section from law, the requirement from law.
And Representative Keller, would you like to make a motion for an amendment?
Thank you for the question. I was under the impression you were wondering if I could request to hold it until we consider that.
I am making that offer if it's going to be a specific amendment. If it is basically a conceptual amendment to determine whether the committee wants to hold and develop that, I would rather have that now so we can, I mean, if you're alone in that, then I think we can make that decision now, and I'd rather not have to force you to go through the development of a specific amendment but I think that we've kind of had the discussion on that.
Chair.
But we are under discussion of the bill, so we've got a couple of people to talk, so can...
Absolutely.
Representative Gardner.
I'm interested in Representative Keller's proposal, and I would like to hear it, if not now, then at some other point.
We're absolutely hearing this proposal as a conceptual amendment or as developed into a specific amendment. This is the discussion time, and so that's what we're doing. Mr. Jeans.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A point of clarity I'd like to provide is that the definition of instructional categories are set out in regulation, not in statute. And they currently include instruction, special education instruction, special education support services for students, support services for instruction, and then school administration, which would be the principal but not the secretarial staff at the individual schools. So those are currently the categories that we have for instruction, and they are in regulation, not in statute.
Okay, and Representative Keller.
With that information, Mr. Chair, I would not ask the committee to hold for an amendment, but I will be objecting as we proceed to the passage of the repeal. So thank
okay.
you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Is there further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, Representative Munoz.
I'd like to move House Bill number 147 with zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
We have a motion to move House Bill 147 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Are there objections? There is an objection. Would you like to speak to your objection?
Yes, please. Thank you. The public school system has lots of roles, and some of these roles go beyond and prioritize things that are not related to the instruction of the student. And they're good things. They're things that we want to maintain. They're part of our educational system. But we have nothing in statute to make the distinction between these roles and the actual role of the instruction of the student, the proficiency of the student, other than our accountability laws. And I think that this particular tool is one that has helped us as a legislature to be engaged in figuring out where the money is going, whether it's for the actual instruction of students or some of these other areas that are really put a lot of pressure on local school boards. And one is the facility. the facility in many places in our state is far more than an educational facility. It's a facility for community. I mean, in my community, which is not rural, you know, I really enjoy the fact that the local school district works really easily with us to use the building for their concerns. So there's also I've been in the rural areas some, and often when you go into town, you figure out that the best transportation in town is provided by the school district, and it may be the only place in town to sleep, you know, and it may be it may be the only place in town to get something to eat because they have a school criteria. They also have nutritional programs in the school. We have so many things that go beyond the actual instruction. There's lots of pressure on the local school boards to take money from the core role of education, which is the instruction of the child, and put it toward meeting the needs of the adults in the system. Now, this may be a crude tool, but it's working. You heard testimony this morning. At least one of the superintendents said that it has affected how they spend their money. They look at it, they examine it, and if they have to get a waiver, the waiver is available and justifiable. And I think it's working even on the level that EED was just explained, went back to the school board and denied non-approval of a waiver. It pulls this up to the surface where we can see it. Our laws are not perfect in defining what is actually for the good of the student with it, so many roles, you know, including daycare, which is good for the children. And our funding formula, for example, does not really incentivize the proficiency. We've left that to the accountability system that we have imposed on a state. And you pick any one of them, and you can't look at it and say, now that is going to cause the district to spend its money toward getting the child taught. You know, you might argue that school size goes there, and it does at some level. Small schools, maybe you could argue, are preferable to large schools, and there's more money offered, you know, in students that are in small schools. But largely, there's just nothing there to incentivize instruction and keeping the focus on the kids. There's just a lot of things that have come up that have told me that this is a useful tool, and I think we're making a mistake if we just reject it out of hand. One thing I think Eddie Jean just indicated, that the dialogue with the districts based on the waiver requests will be lost. And I think your argument was that that's been picked up by the requirements of SB 285 in a low-performing school. But I would argue that that may be true, but that kind of leaves the legislature out of that at some level. With this being in the statute and providing a little bit of pressure there, it's been effective. I think it's still effective. I think the superintendents this morning told us it was still effective when they described how they work. We want local control, but there is an element where the legislature should be involved in increasing the pressure to keep the focus on the children, on proficiency, on instruction. So I respectfully will not vote to eliminate this tool that I think is still very valuable. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Other comments? I guess I would just say that, you know, we do have newer, more modern instruments to look at accountability in schools, and that's what this was drawn from. You know, 10 years ago, that's what we were trying to do. We didn't have the newer tools, we didn't have AYP, we weren't measuring every year kids' progress, we didn't have growth so that we could look at individual student growth with individual identifiers, and so we could see what was happening there. You know, our schools are so different between one and another, and when you have a local school board looking at their students and saying, what do we need to do to promote this education and get growth in meeting the standards and meeting AYP, and to step back and say that we want to use a a blunt tool across all of them, as if that will accomplish better than the individual looking at the individual situation. And I don't think that we sitting here are very good at looking at all those individual situations and be able to craft a law that will work on all of those without doing what we've already done, and that is gone to individual student assessment. And so I understand the idea of saying, well, let's take fuel out of the equation, but that's exactly what the 70% was saying. We wanted into instruction, and now we would be saying, well, we're going to take some categories of operation and maintenance and declare that operation and maintenance instruction, and, you know, just to fudge the numbers, because that's what we would be doing in my opinion if we said, okay, let's take parts of operation and say it's there. And the other thing that we've got is we've got a huge discrepancy among schools based on whether they're new schools or old schools, and whether we funded the construction of a new school that's tight and weatherized and doesn't require a lot of maintenance, or we've got an old school that it'll never meet it because we haven't funded a new school, or because the people in the large district, urban district, didn't vote for a bond issue to replace school, and so they've got a lot of maintenance costs. The maintenance costs go in, but 70-30, you know, the debt reimbursement on a capital doesn't. So I think that the tool is blunter than it should be. So, you know, I think that we should move on, and that's my...
Just a quick follow-up. I would say that the, like in the construction of a school, in the facilities costs and that kind of thing, I would say that this, as you what you call a blunt tool, is exactly what brought that discussion to the light of this committee. You know, it may be a blunt tool, but it's working. And another thing I would say is, again, if there's going to be a zero fiscal note on this, and you just heard testimony of the fact that this is not a huge cost to maintain this tool in the department, and I think you've heard from the school districts that they really resent, and I understand. I mean, I'm not trying to be callous on that one. I understand the resentment toward having this tool out there, but the actual mechanism for getting the report in is not that onerous. A letter requesting a waiver and justifying where the money is being spent is not that tough. What the tough part is the decisions that actually come to the how you spend the money. And therefore, I would argue again that it's a good tool. So,
thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really, when I'm looking at it, if the school is making AYP, and to me, that's what my concern is. My concern is whether those children are making progress from year to year, and they're going to be good students. And so I really don't care how the school does it, and I don't care where they spend their money as long as they're doing it. And so I would say that the majority of school boards, that's their concern too. They want, I mean, they're in the community. They want their kids to be able to do well. And because the schools are different, and even in urban areas, my goodness, look at Anchorage. I don't know how they do it when sometimes the people of the state vote down, or of the town vote down something when they really need some new schools or whatever. So I mean, this one isn't a rural urban problem. It's all over the place, you know, all across the state. So because I want to zero in on the student and how well they're doing, and if it means that it's 68% that goes into the schoolroom instead of 70, but they're meeting AYP, more power to them. And so for that reason, that's kind of where I'm for this bill, because only because we've got the for the schools that aren't meeting AYP, we do have the sideboards in place so that they can go in, the department can go in and really do something. So anyway, because of that, I'm going to go ahead and vote for it.
Are there other comments from the committee before we vote? Seeing none, Secretary, would you please call the roll? And this is for the passage of HB 147 from committee with individual recommendations attached. Fiscal note.
HB 147, Representative Munoz.
Yes.
Representative Wilson.
Yes.
Representative Edgman is absent. Representative Kellum.
No.
Representative Few.
Yes.
Representative Gardner.
No.
Chair Seaton.
Yes.
I have four yeas, two nays.
And with that, HB 147 will move from committee with individual recommendations. Pass fiscal note. We have...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We have one further bill that I wanted to bring up so that we get some amendments brought forward. We just haven't had time to... been a busy day. Always trying to schedule more than we were able to get through. We have some people that were online to testify. And before we go to that, I wanted to check how many committee members have to leave right now, or we can spend a few minutes. You need to leave?
5 minutes.
Five minutes. Yeah, so we will take another, we'll take 5 minutes on House Bill 126. Representative Guerra, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll proceed any way you wish. There are a few people who've been online from outside of Juneau, or there are a couple amendments that we've written to address concerns of the chair, Representative Gardner, and then a couple of Student Loan Corporation and OCS, so they're sort of cleanup amendments.
Well, we've got the amendments out here, but let's go ahead and take the public testimony, so because they've been online before, and then we, at least the amendments will be in the packets if we don't get them adopted today. The first person was Lauren Rice, I believe. Lauren, are you there?
I'm here.
Would you identify yourself and who you're representing for the record, and go ahead.
My name is Lauren Rice, and I am the Director of Advocacy for Covenant House Alaska, and I am testifying in favor of House Bill 126 on behalf of Covenant House Alaska. And I will try to make this really quickly. Covenant House is a homeless shelter in downtown Anchorage, but we also have four programs total to serve homeless youth in Alaska. And two of them are transitional living programs, and one of them is the Community Services Center, where youth can come in and get help with their resume and get professional clothes and also stay in school through their homeless transition. And then finally, the first one that I mentioned is our Crisis Center, where we take kids literally from off the street who are in emergency situations. Nearly 50% of the youth that we serve have been involved in the foster care system at some point. Most of our youth arrive at our doorstep with nothing other than a plastic bag full of a couple of items. And what we find is that youth are able to make it for a couple of months after they've been released from care, but just like any other 18-year-old, most of them don't have the life skills and the resources completely on their own to make the transition into adulthood safely and successfully. So after living traumatizing lives, they're faced with a new trauma, and that's homelessness and the dangers that homelessness presents. We know more today about what foster care youth need than we have ever known in the past. Some of this is research-based, some of this is learned from tragic lessons, but most of this information comes directly from the graduates of the foster care system, and they have come back to us as advocates, and they are telling us exactly what needs to be changed, exactly what resources they needed, and exactly what did not work for them. So to fail to hear their voices, and I do believe their voices are represented in this bill, to fail to hear those voices would be a disservice to them, as well as all the children that are currently in the foster care system. We know we can lessen trauma by ensuring our children are able to stay enrolled in their home school despite foster care place change, foster care placement changes. We know that frequent visits with their social worker increase the likelihood that they are not being neglected and abused within their placement. We know that older youth, just like any other teen, need transitional assistance to make it safely to adulthood. This legislation is fundamentally about providing our foster care youth with the resources that we naturally would provide to our own children. Very few of us would cut the cord completely when our kids turn 18 and refuse to assist them with educational, occupational, and housing needs. This bill ensures that while we cannot completely ensure that they're not traumatized, we can lessen that trauma and we can take active steps to help them in reasonable, responsible ways. So Covenant House supports this bill. I'm open to any questions, but it is our experience that both caring for them while they're in care and then assisting them with the transition will lessen their trauma, it will lessen the likelihood that they'll end up homeless, and it will increase their safe transition to adulthood.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Are there questions for Ms. Rice? Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you for your testimony. I think it was really very excellent and on point, and it's wonderful to hear your voice, Lauren.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lauren. We had two other people that were online, Barb Dexter and Teresa Tenery, and they were listening. Did you want to offer testimony as well? This time, hearing none, is there anyone else in the audience that wants to come forward and identify yourself on the record, please? Yeah. Welcome.
Hi, Representative Seaton and members of the committee, thank you. I'm Carol Como, the superintendent in Anchorage. I just have a couple of things to say. One, I will support anything that we can do to support foster kids and children awaiting foster care placement. It's becoming very traumatic in Anchorage. We have over 2,000 students who have been identified as homeless in our school district, and those are just the ones we have identified and located. I have a couple of things I'm concerned about, and I may have not found it in the bill. We are already providing transportation for students who are homeless to their school of origin for the school year. And last spring, we added about $175,000 additional into our general fund to pay for the cabs and the buses that we had to add. So I have a concern that if this is defined as one school year rather than forever, because the federal law speaks to the one calendar, the school year, and then if the child is still in the foster care of the same family, then they would need to go to the school in the area that they were zoned into. And so that is important to us, that if that could be defined. And then the other thing I would like to ask about is under B on the page 2 of the proposed legislation, where it says the superintendent of the school district makes a written finding that a waiver of the requirements is in the student's best academic interest, and the finding is mailed to the school board and to the person in charge of children's services for the Department of Health and Social Services, and that's one of the exceptions to the law. What are those criteria? I mean, I can't imagine that I'm going to sit there and go through all of the students' records, have to meet with the families and so forth, and make an independent decision on that. So I guess I need a little bit more definition of that. But philosophically, I can tell you that we're supporting any way we can support our students awaiting foster care and in foster care. And we would like to work with Representative Guerra and the other sponsors on some of those issues.
Appreciate that. And you're raising some questions that we had concerns about, too. Okay. Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, thank you. The second point that you raised, Superintendent, was exactly my concern, and it's addressed in the amendment that's before the committee, and it would be that section is actually deleted because it's addressed in the McKinney-Vento legislation that waivers can be requested by the student, the parent, or guardian, and granted.
And I'll have to get a hold of a copy of the amendments. Thank you.
Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we're short on time, but I was just wondering if the testifier knew our rule about cell phones, and I was wondering how Anchorage School District donuts were going to taste here.
I'll bring you your fine, whatever. Yeah, that I thought I'd turn it off. I apologize. Thank you.
Let's see. Are there further questions for or comments for Carol? We appreciate you coming in and sharing those items with us. And as you look through that bill, if there or and the amendments, if there's any other things that draw your concern, we'd appreciate hearing about those.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify? Representative Guerra, would you?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, the amendment the two amendments you have before you actually address both of Superintendent Como's concerns, and I can explain them if you'd like.
Sure. Would you take just a moment and go ahead?
Yeah. The major amendment, the big fix-up amendment, was prompted by concerns that Representative Gardner made. And what we found, and Representative Gardner's concerns were, what is this new process we're going to come up with to allow an exception if we think the child should move to a new school? So we know generally we should try and keep children in the same school as they move in the middle of a school year. Foster children sometimes 5, 10, 15 placements, and we'll try and keep them in the same school. But there are times where moving to the new school makes sense. And so we tried to come up with standards, but as it turns out, the McKinney-Vento Act, which we're incorporating in here, actually already has standards. As Ms. Como states, you're trying to keep the youth in the same school through the end of the school year. And so that's how McKinney-Vento works. It just works through the end of the school year. And then, as Representative Gardner stated, you want to take in the youth's concerns, the guardian's concerns. And McKinney-Vento says we should keep the child in the same school unless the youth or guardian or parent come in and say, have a good reason to say, no, the newer school makes sense. And so there's already a procedure under McKinney-Vento. The school district has already been using that procedure for the class of children who are covered, which is homeless children and children awaiting foster care. So the amendment actually just defers to the process that the McKinney-Vento statute uses, which is to take in child input, to take in parent input, and to take in guardian input. So that's essentially what the big fix-up amendment does. And then the second concern...
Before we go, I get scared when you say we're incorporating federal law into here.
Right.
So would you go through...
Yeah.
I mean, because I don't think we're incorporating the McKinney-Vento statute into or federal law into this statute, are we?
Mr. Chair, if you look at page one of the bill.
Page one of the bill or the amendment?
Of the bill.
Okay.
Page one, the goal of this section is this. Right now, there's federal funding to keep children in the same school. With the exceptions that are in the federal statute if the child and parent and guardian think a transfer makes more sense. There's a federal law that says for children who are homeless and those foster children, just those foster children in emergency care or awaiting foster care, that group of children, there's federal funding to provide transportation to keep children in the same school. There's been a national movement in the foster care field to say, we want to allow all foster youth as they get bounced between placements to stay in the same school under the same standards. And so this legislation would just provide funding to allow school districts to keep all foster youth, not just those awaiting foster care, but those also in foster care who get bounced between homes in the same school. And rather than come up with a different state standard for saying, under this circumstance, we'll allow a school transfer. Under that circumstance, we'll allow a school transfer. We're going to just incorporate the standards that the school districts have already been using with McKinney-Vento for those kids who are already covered. If we came up with new standards, you'd have this very weird process where the children covered by McKinney-Vento, let's say somebody awaiting foster care, this would be the process for deciding whether they stay in the school, same school. But then we'd have to tell school districts for children who are in foster care, this would be a different standard that you would use for determining whether children stay in the same school. There's been no discussion in any of the conferences I've been into or any of the discussion with the folks at the school district that McKinney-Vento doesn't work. It essentially is funding to allow children to stay in the same school, unless the youth or the guardians say, wait a second, the new school actually makes more sense. And it's pretty simple. It's actually pretty regal, and it it addressed Representative Gardner's concerns the other day about what standard we were going to use. We'll just use what the school districts are already using.
My concern is the statement that we're incorporating McKinto Vendi. I mean, are we my understanding is that's a very thick bill which has a lot of different provisions. Your language here doesn't incorporate the entire statute. Does it incorporate the entire McKinney-Vento Homeless Education Assistance Improvement Act, or does it rely on the standards that are adopted in that?
Mr. Chair, you're right. The act addresses a number of different issues. We're just incorporating the part that says funding available to keep children in the same school where appropriate. And so that's really what Section 1 says. We're just going to expand the class of foster children that get transportation services. Right now it's just foster children awaiting placement, and we're saying it should be all foster children.
Okay, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. If that's clear, I don't need to say anything else if the committee understands. Now, what we're doing is just expanding the population. There are kids who are technically in foster care. They're in state custody, but they don't have a foster home, and they're in a shelter or some other kind of facility. McKinney-Vento applies to them. Once they get a foster home and actually go with a foster mom and dad, then McKinney-Vento no longer applies, and they have to change schools under current practice and law. And this would simply say we're going to apply the transportation and homeschool components of McKinney-Vento to children who now are no longer homeless because they have a foster home. Because there are shelters for lots of kids waiting to get into a home. And sometimes, I mean, I'm a little bit out of the loop. I don't remember how many there are and what they're called, but they're kind of emergency temporary placements that are like group homes that sometimes kids languish there for a long, long time, particularly teenagers.
Representative Keller.
Thank you. I was wondering if, just a clarification for me, I believe the previous testifier said that there's $175,000 spent for transportation. She's still here, but if you want to call her back up, but did they recover that money under McKinney-Vento, or do we need this state law to ensure that we can get the federal money available, or is it just an expansion of principle here that needs to?
Sure. You should bring Superintendent Como up if I get this wrong, but this is the way it works right now. The portion of foster youth and homeless youth that are covered by federal law now, federal money provides services so that you can provide transportation to keep children in the same school through the end of the school year, short $175,000. So the school district, the Anchorage School District, has, for that class of foster youth and homeless youth, been putting in an extra $175,000 on top of the roughly $1 million that comes in from McKinney-Vento. And we're saying that the state shall provide funding for the remainder of the foster youth who don't get covered.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton, through the chair.
Would you identify yourself?
I'm Carol Como again from Anchorage. Representative Keller, we took the additional $175 out of our general fund allocation. It was not to make. We did not get additional funding from the federal government to cover these students that met the criteria, and this bill would be an expansion of that. But we believe it's valid for this school year, as long as it was only for the school year, that it was not forever and ever. I mean, we do believe that at the end of a school year, then the provision of transportation would cease, other than if they lived in that attendance area.
Representative Keller.
I just thank you. If you said that before and I missed it, I'm sorry, but thank you for the clarification.
Carol, before you leave, maybe you're the right one to ask this question. My understanding was there was $170,000 that came to the state, and it was done on competitive grants. Do you just automatically get the money from the state, or is it competitive grants between applications by the various districts for the money from the state?
Representative Seaton, I don't believe I know that. You'd have to ask Eddie James. I know out of our general fund with our appropriation that we got last year from the legislature at the end of the year when we did end-of-year budget adjustments, we had exceeded what was in the budget by $175,000 to provide cabs, buses, and so forth, transportation. So that came out of our appropriation. I really don't know what the state got as far as McKinney-Vento, and I know that what we get is through the McKinney-Vento Title I Act, and how that exactly flows through, I'm not sure. But this was out of our general fund over and above. It's the same thing we've had to do for years with special education. When it's exceeded what we've received, it comes out of our regular ed, if you will, appropriations.
Sure, and we'll have to have Mr. Jeans come up at our next time and go through how much money comes to the state, how that pass-through goes and is distributed among the various districts. And can you take just about 10 seconds and explain the second amendment that we have on the table?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The other amendment was flagged by the chair. You don't want to have an unfunded mandate. So there are two provisions of the bill where non-state entities are asked to do things. One is we're asking school districts to help keep children in the same school as they bounce between foster homes. And then one is we ask the university to help with financial assistance. And on those provisions, we're saying the requirements of this section are contingent upon adequate legislative funding. And if the legislature doesn't fund them, then the school district and the university don't have to do those things. If the legislature does fund them, then they do. But we don't want to have an unfunded mandate that says you have to do these things without state funds.
Okay, and for the next time, would you identify financing, how that would go forward? Because I presume it would have to be for the coming fiscal year budget, not retroactively, so to figure out how the districts are going to know the funds are available or what funds are available and those kind of things. So procedurally, you would go through that. We had Barbara Dexter online, had wanted to testify, but we're out of time today, so when we take up the bill again, we'll take her first in public testimony. So I'm leaving public testimony on this bill open.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would you like to move the amendments so they can be incorporated in the meantime?
I think that it's pretty good size amendments, and I think we ought to look at them. So we'll look at them and move them at the next time so that the committee members have time. So we will be adjourned, and I appreciate the committee's indulgence in extending the meeting, and it is now 10:32.